Greetings and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in Word Magazine number 151, I'm going to be offering a spoken word version of a book review that I have recently written. The book review is of a book by a fellow named Grantley MacDonald. It is titled Biblical Criticism in Early Modern Europe, subtitled Erasmus, the Johannine Coma, and Trinitarian Debate. It was published by Cambridge University Press in 2016, and it is 384 pages in length. As I said, this book was published now nearly 4 years ago in 2016, and I read it, I think, probably 2 years ago, and I took pretty copious notes on it, but I had not yet written a review until this past week. I sat down and finally was able to write out a review. And I hopefully will submit this review to a journal where it will be published. For now, though, I'm just going to give you this draft version as a read-through. And I will not be able to put the entire thing up on my blog at jeffriddle.net, but I probably will put up maybe the couple of closing paragraphs from the review. And then hopefully, again, it'll eventually appear in a journal, and then I'll be able to put the finished product on my academia.edu page. So I thought that this book was timely, given some recent discussions that I've been involved with, including the recent podcast that I was on with Peter Gurry and James Snap Jr., and then some of the follow-up discussions about that. Because this book is about, obviously, the Johannine Coma. And I think the author of this book puts forward some very intriguing ideas about the historical background of conflict over the coma, but also the contemporary conflict that still goes on with regard to the coma. And he says that the conflict is not just about the evidence, but it's about worldview. And so without any further ado, let me go ahead and commence this read-through of Grantley MacDonald's book, Biblical Criticism in Early Modern Europe, subtitled Erasmus, the Johannine Coma, and Trinitarian Debate. This book is a revision of the author's 2011 doctoral dissertation completed at the University of Leuven under the direction of Dr. Henk de Jong. It is an extensive study of the reception history of one of the most disputed texts in the New Testament, the so-called Three Heavenly Witnesses passage, or Johannine Coma, found in 1 John 5, verses 7 and 8. MacDonald, the author, suggests that the coma, whose authenticity has been soundly rejected by modern academic textual criticism, has remained, nevertheless, what he calls an unquiet corpse. I love that image of an unquiet corpse. And he says this unquiet corpse's transmission history serves as what he calls a keyhole that allows us to peer straight into the heart of the violent struggles over the understanding of the Trinity that took place from the 16th to the 19th centuries. Let me begin with a survey of the content of this book. This study begins by tracing the eventual inclusion of the coma following controversy and criticism in the printed editions of Erasmus's Greek New Testament, beginning with his third edition of 1522. So the coma was not in the first two editions of Erasmus, the 1516, the 1519, but he included it in his 1522 edition. Particularly helpful in this survey is the author's careful review and analysis of the origins of a document known as Codex Montfortianus, or as Codex 61, and its influence on Erasmus's deliberations regarding the coma. In this survey, MacDonald challenges a common scholarly assumption that this manuscript, Codex 61, was produced by someone named Frater Froik, or Froy or Roy, and you will often see this in various textbooks and writings, even from people who are established academics in the field of text criticism. MacDonald, however, notes that the origins of Codex 61 are at best, as he puts it, unclear. Next, the author traces how Erasmus's inclusion of the coma in 1522 influenced later printed editions of the Greek New Testament and vernacular translations made from them, including those in English from Tyndale to the King James Version. And these were translations which incorporated the disputed passage, the coma. And then he goes on to talk about the widespread acceptance of the coma in the text of the Bible under the influence of Erasmus's pivotal editorial decision in 1522. That this became a flashpoint of philological dispute regarding the text of Scripture and doctrinal controversy regarding the doctrine of the Trinity from the 16th century onward. MacDonald traces the development of anti-Trinitarian sentiments as early as Miguel Servet or Servetus in Calvin's Geneva and the Polish Socinians. Which the Socinian anti-Trinitarian idea spread throughout, in particular, Eastern Europe and then on into Western Europe. This was, to use MacDonald's terms, a raising of the ghost of Arius, a raising of the ghost of Arianism, the denial of the deity of Christ. It led various Christian communions to double down in their affirmation of the coma from Lutherans, some of whom, including Luther, were initially skeptical about the authenticity of the coma, and other Protestants, to Roman Catholics in their affirmation of the Vulgate at Trent, and even to the Eastern Orthodox. So because of the anti-Trinitarian sentiment of the 16th, 17th centuries, it led Protestants, Catholics, and Eastern Orthodox to double down in their affirmation of the coma. And again, he notes that Luther, in his initial translation of the German Bible, because he was dependent upon the early editions of Erasmus, did not include the coma. But when these Trinitarian flashpoints developed, later Lutherans, like Melanchthon, affirmed the coma. And so the coma became a part of the Lutheran Protestant tradition as well. MacDonald next turns in particular to the coma's reception in England from the historical periods of the Civil War in England to the Enlightenment, a survey which encompasses the bulk of this book's content. So the biggest chapter in this book is chapter 4. It's from pages 117 to 278, which is this survey of the coma's reception within England. Here the author points out how the authenticity of the coma was alternately attacked by anti-Trinitarian and rationalistic thinkers, consisting of luminaries no less the likes than John Milton, Isaac Newton, and Edward Gibbon, Gibbon being the author of the famous Rise and Decline of the Roman Empire. Newton, of course, the famous mathematician and scientist, Milton, the great poet, they were all anti-Trinitarians and opposed the authenticity of the coma. Meanwhile, the coma was defended by the Orthodox and by traditionalists, consisting of men of equal standing, including John Bunyan, the author of Pilgrim's Progress, Jonathan Swift, and John Wesley. among others. This chapter is brimming with information and anecdotes related to this controversy. Among the intriguing points is McDonald's suggestion that, quote, the first fully developed narration of the myth of Erasmus's promise, end quote, to Edward Lee to include the coma contingent on his being shown a Greek manuscript containing it, supposedly satisfied by Codex 61, this is sometimes known as the rash wager anecdote, that this was first made in the year 1722 by a man named David Martin, drawing on the historical critical work of Richard Simon, who's often considered one of the fathers of the historical critical method. So again, he traces the Erasmian myth or anecdote to the early 18th century about the rash wager. Finally, this study examines the reception of the coma in what McDonald calls the long 19th century. McDonald begins by describing how the legend of Erasmus's showdown with Edward Lee took on a life of its own. It sprouted apocryphal details, and it continued to be used by skeptic and traditionalist alike in later debates. It became something like a wax nose to depict, quote, Erasmus the conservative, Erasmus the radical, Erasmus the honest scholar, Erasmus the coward, Erasmus the good Catholic, or Erasmus the proto-Socinian, end quote. He notes the development of Unitarianism in England and the so-called critical advances of Lachmann and Tischendorf, which challenged the coma's authenticity, as well as renewed defenses of the coma by men like Frederick Nolan. A watershed challenge to the coma came with the Greek text of Westcott and Hort and the revised version English translation that came from it. But the coma was retained by traditionalists like F.H.A. Scribner in his revised edition of the Greek New Testament published in 1894, which became the preferred text of the Trinitarian Bible Society. Not to limit the discussion merely to the Protestants, McDonald also notes how the coma became a point of dispute in the Catholic modernist controversy of the 19th century, finally ending with the Roman Catholic Nova Vulgata, or New Vulgate, of 1979, which was a Catholic Bible which for the first time excluded the coma. MacDonald then observes, quote, Erasmus's initial judgment on the Johannine coma was finally vindicated, end quote. That is, Erasmus initially had thought the coma was not part of the text of the New Testament. And MacDonald says, finally, Erasmus's original judgment as evidenced in the first two editions of his Greek New Testament was vindicated as Protestants and Catholic alike, among scholars at least, in the 19th century rejected the coma. MacDonald concludes his work by reflecting on the significance of over 500 years of conflict regarding the Johannine coma. He notes, quote, one of the most surprising things about the Johannine coma is its resilience, end quote. He further suggests that whereas in previous generations, quote, the debate was driven by fear of the perceived threat of Socinians, Unitarians, Roman Catholics, or modernists, today this anxiety has been replaced by the fear that Christianity is under attack from science and liberal humanism, end quote. He concludes, quote, the question of the coma is thus not merely a dusty chapter in the annals of biblical scholarship, but a microcosm of the cultural and religious conflicts in which we find ourselves right now, end quote. So again, his assessment was, if you trace the 16th to 19th centuries, the coma was controversial because there was a Trinitarian dispute. There were the anti-Trinitarians, eventually Unitarians, who rejected the Trinity, and therefore they rejected the coma. And there were the traditional Orthodox Christians who affirmed the Trinity and therefore defended the coma. And he says, now, in contemporary times, we have another dispute, but now the dispute isn't about the Trinity, but it's about the Bible itself and authority. And on one side, you have conservative Christians, even fundamentalists, who are defending the coma and who are fearful of liberalism and humanism and scientism. And on the other hand, you have enlightened scholars and liberals who are writing the coma off as an interpolation. So that's a survey of the content of the book. And let me turn now to offer some analysis. This work represents a significant contribution to what is called the reception history. And this is considered sort of a sub-discipline of biblical studies, when you study how a passage has been received within the history of Christianity. And so this is an important contribution to the reception history. I said the history of Christianity. We could say the history of Western thought or Western culture. How has it been received? But anyways, so it's an important intellectual history of the reception of the Johannine coma from Erasmus, the time of Erasmus, to the present day. Any future study of this controversial New Testament passage will need to consult, benefit from, and make reference to this work. It's really that important. I think both MacDonald's dissertation of 2011 and this book, which is taken from it, anyone who does any serious work on the coma will have to make reference to this work. It's that important. This reviewer is especially appreciative of MacDonald's debunking of the Erasmian myths that have developed relating to his inclusion of the coma in the 1522 third edition of the Dutch Scholar's Greek New Testament, as well as those relating to the history and influence of Codex Montfortianus. And these Erasmian anecdotes continue to circulate. And because MacDonald was a doctoral student of Hank de Jong, and de Jong in the early 80s also wrote about these Erasmian myths, we can see his influence upon his student, MacDonald. One of the most intriguing ideas put forward by MacDonald in this study is his analysis and application of the postmodern philosopher Michel Foucault's concept of the episteme, that's E-P-I-S-T-E-M-E, his concept of the episteme, to understand the division that has resulted historically over the acceptance of the coma. An episteme is defined as, quote, an internally consistent mode of conceiving the world that determines which questions may conceivably be asked and thus judged to be either true or false, end quote. In what MacDonald calls the pre-modern episteme, critical thought was subordinated to a theological a priori. So again, he says in the pre-modern episteme, or a conceptual model of determining how questions may be asked and judge whether they are true or false, critical concerns were subordinate to doctrinal concerns. This meant, for example, quote, it was almost inconceivable to doubt the inspiration of Scripture, end quote, under the pre-modern episteme. With the development of the historical critical method, however, beginning with Richard Simon and Baruch Spinoza, critical questions were disconnected from theological ones. Though MacDonald doesn't use this term, we might call it, in contrast to the pre-modern episteme, the modern episteme, or maybe even the postmodern episteme. Rather than one episteme neatly yielding sequentially to the next, as Foucault conceived it, MacDonald suggests that, quote, the episteme that existed before Spinoza and Simon never ended. Rather, their work fractured the hermeneutical consensus, leading to a situation in which two epistemes came to exist in parallel. So let me just go back on this. He says, Foucault, the postmodern philosopher, said that one episteme, one worldview, is sequentially followed by another. So according to his theory, the pre-modern episteme should have been followed and supplanted by, replaced by, the modern episteme. But MacDonald says that's not what happened. Instead, we have two epistemes that have continued in a parallel track. There's the pre-modern episteme and the modern episteme. MacDonald describes these two parallel epistemes as follows, quote, one maintains an essentially pre-modern attitude towards Scripture, submitting judgment in textual matters to the ultimate criterion of doctrine, while the other has accepted, internalized, and built upon the insights of Spinoza and Simon, using the tools of philology, history, and sociology to illuminate the beginnings of Christianity, end quote. He concludes, quote, I suggest that many of the conflicts between academic liberal critics and conservative apologists arise out of a basic epistemological incompatibility, end quote. It is this fundamental epistemological incompatibility that compels disagreement over the Johannine coma, as those who hold the pre-modern episteme continue to affirm it, while those who hold the modern episteme continue to reject it. According to MacDonald, then, the reception of the coma represents a proverbial fork in the road. As MacDonald puts it, quote, one path was followed by those who insisted on the providential preservation of Scripture. The other was taken by those who believed that Scripture, whatever its source, is subject to the same process of transmission as any other text, end quote. The story that results is one of, quote, constantly competing claims, in which outcomes are rarely clear and motives are often obscure, end quote. And I think anyone who listened to my discussion with Gurry and Snap would recognize a clash of epistemes, epistemological incompatibility, where one path, the confessional text position, is one of the path of providential preservation. The other path, although they may use the language of preservation, I think he's got it, MacDonald has it absolutely right. And that is the fundamental difference is they believe that Scripture is subject to the same process of transmission as any other text. And they can't understand why we can't see it that way. Let me continue the review. This is the last paragraph. MacDonald is hardly sympathetic to those who continue to uphold the coma against the modern scholarly consensus held since the mid-20th century that the Three Heavenly Witnesses passage is a spurious and late interpolation. So my point here is that MacDonald is obviously himself a modern academic scholar, and He has no sympathy at all to conservatives who would uphold the authenticity of the coma. He associates renewed debate over the coma to what he calls the revival of the Christian right, to conspiracy theories and internet discussions where it has become a hot button issue. McDonald suggests, quote, as a result of an informational cascade amongst non-scholarly believers, the divide between academic consensus and lay conviction is growing, end quote. So it's interesting. He notes that there's a divide between the academy, which is in lockstep, that the coma is spurious, and the person in the pew who, for some reason, will not let go of this lively corpse of the coma. What McDonald does not explicitly seem to acknowledge is that he is hardly a neutral observer. He holds, in fact, to the modern episteme, which he so helpfully describes. Nevertheless, McDonald is to be thanked not only for his impressive historical review of the various clashes over the coma in the modern period, but also for his insights on the epistemological divide over this matter. To paraphrase the poet Robert Frost, when we come to the coma Ioanneum as a fork in the road, the path we take does indeed make all the difference. Well, this ends this review of Grantley McDonald's book, Biblical Criticism in Early Modern Europe, subtitled Erasmus, the Johannine Coma, and Trinitarian Debate. I hope that this review has been helpful for those who have been listening. Again, you can go to my blog, jeffriddle.net. I'll at least post probably the last couple of paragraphs of this draft of my written review of this book. And hopefully once it gets published somewhere, I'll put the entirety of the finished written review up on my academia.edu page. Thank you for being part of this Word magazine, and I will look forward to speaking to you in the next episode. Till then, take care and God bless.